All right, recording is on. Welcome to the call. Reminder that this is a Linux Foundation meeting inside of Hyperledger. So both the Hyperledger Code of Conduct and the Linux Foundation Antitrust Policy abide. Let's be very nice and excellent to each other, not break any laws as we work together. If you could, I need to find the chat window here. You are welcome to add yourself as an attendee. On the page here itself, and then we will let me pop into edit mode here. You're also welcome, by the way, down here on the agenda. We are doing RFC progression and review. I've added a couple. Please add while we're getting started here any RFCs that you want to see progress made or that you think warrants a discussion right here in the group call itself. Go ahead and do that while we're getting started, and we will have ourselves a rousing discussion. Announcements: BCGov still looking to collaborate with folks building mobile agents. Contact Stephen Curran. And then here's two remaining announcements about the Aries RFC process. We could probably kill the RS the moved thing since they've all been moved at this point. And then we have some growth in Aries SDK repos, but we will talk about that in a minute. First, we had a call. Our prior call was quite good. The recording is posted with lots of discussion about the peer did spec and other things. We had a morning call. Do we have Richard on today?
Yeah, I'm here.
Richard, well, you want to give us a summary of this morning's call?
Yes, though you were an equal participant, so feel free to pitch into my summary. But we had quite a few attendees, which was really good, people that don't usually attend the afternoon call. The main topic of conversation, spent half of the call talking about the architecture of a future Aries, lib Aries or Aries SDK, probably not an SDK, probably more of a lib Aries. And specifically, I think we have a lot of consensus that we do want a C callable lib Aries that implements some basic types, concepts for Aries. We do want it in Rust. We'll probably take the Indie SDK as a starting point, especially for the wallet, and try to abstract the resolver. We would like somebody else to implement, of course, we have the Indie Resolver as an example, but we want to make sure it's a generic enough interface. So we're really interested in seeing who else would be willing to implement a resolver for a different ledger. And the biggest, for the future decisions we need to make is whether we preserve the Indie threading model, at least for a short period of time, or whether we try to change the threading model to something easier to adopt in the short term. And there was some question about whether lib null pay should be an Indie thing or whether it should also move to Aries. So there's a no op implementation of payments in Aries. And the CLI, what should be the role of a CLI in the future? Is it an Indie sysadmin tool or is it also an Aries development tool for inspecting a system? So we'll cover those topics in future calls. Anything you'd like to add, Sam?
Whatever I do, I should unmute first. Is the recording posted yet?
Yes, it is.
Recording is posted, so please go listen on that, and we value your feedback as we're moving forward.
Hey, I'll throw one thing on that. The drawings that were put out were really good. So take a look, if nothing else, look at those the drawings that were posted. Of the split between Aries and Indie.
Got some diagrams and stuff.
Thank you, Ken and Adam, for taking the verbal conversation and turning it into some practical diagrams we can use.
Yes. Yes, it was a good call. It was very, very good. Any updates from the URSA or Indie Semantics meetings this last week?
Semantics did not meet this last week, so there's no update.
Okay. I have, someone has added the did a UX working group.
Yes, I did that. I think it's worth to mention about this meeting. It was basically a kickoff meeting for a user experience, not specifically with DIT. It's called DIT UX, but actually I think that everyone agrees that user experience in a context of decentralized world, of course, we'll start with the simple identity parts and things like this. There will be a mailing list. There is already on Sovereign Rocket Chat a channel for UX related topics, but mainly, as we agreed, we'll use a mailing list, which will be published quite soon, and then all the information will be we will communicate through this mailing list. And overall, this was just organizational topics, a short introduction of everyone interest, and some potential topics for the future. So there will be some notes from that meeting sent out. As soon as I will get it, I can share it as well here.
Excellent. And if you would come and add the link to the notes to this meeting agenda, it will help people find it if they're listening to the meeting or if they're looking
at it. We'll do that. Yeah.
Appreciate that. Sam, is this a discussion for the RFC progression, or is this something for a related meeting? Sam Smith. I'm pausing.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I was muted and I couldn't find my window. Last week, I was given the assignment of writing up an issue. We were discussing inline DID for the DIDCOM block for routing and stuff like that. And I suggested using DID query to provide the authentication material, such as the crypto suite type and stuff like that, so somebody could verify a signature without having to do a DID document lookup. I don't know if you remember that.
Vaguely, yes. Is this your write-up on the issue?
Yes. And I don't know if it's worthy of more discussion or not.
I don't know either, but we can sure bring it up. Let's bring it. Let's talk about it further down in the RFC, in the main part of the agenda when we get there. But I appreciate your work there.
All right. Okay. So, do you want me to copy, or do you want to move it down,
or something? Yeah. Why don't you go ahead and move that down in there somewhere where it's appropriate, and then we'll talk about upcoming releases and work updates first.
All right.
Awesome. BC Gov has been doing lots of awesome work on the Aries Cloud and Python. Can you give us a review, someone from the BC Gov team?
Sure. Can I share for a moment?
You can share.
I'll just show the stuff that I showed earlier. So big thing is there's now release done. So I'll share a link to, but we've now got tagged releases and releases to PyPI. So 0.20 was released and a hot fix moments later released. So there are release notes. We do have to work better at getting our pull request names better, but there are release notes tied to all the PRs that were done. As far as updates, here's a list of updates done. API security, we've added that when starting up the agent, you have to either explicitly say it's going to be insecure or add a token. So that's now done. We do have a bunch of demos we're updating. The local agent support is still being worked, so I'm working on that a bit still, but Docker and play with Docker both work pretty well and all that. The Acme is a extension of Alice Faber where you're given a hunk of code with a bunch of to-dos in it and expected to add code to figure out what you do as in writing a controller. Progress in using this agent as Indie Catalyst. So that's Indie Catalyst underlies the org book, and so shooting credentials between ACA Pi agents, underlying BC registries in the org book. So that's really, that's big progress for us. A couple of other things, did exchange protocol. We can now start up a connection based on public bid. So there's some things there. There's a very cool performance demo that people might want to take a look at where we spin up two agents and pass 300 credentials to them, but another version an implementation of it includes three agents where Alice has a routing agent as well and passes all of the messages go through the routing agent. So demonstrates how to do that, which is kind of cool and important. And the performance is not significantly impacted when that third agent is added in. And then down here is a list of the pending work we've got going. Adding a couple of things in there. The big thing we're looking at is the Indy Catalyst implementation where we're adding the horizontal scaling. Now, one other thing to mention. So Sam asked us if we would do a deep dive into the ACA PI architecture. So we are going to do a session on next Tuesday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific time. And we'll post the time of that and the Zoom session to use. But we're having a session on that where we're going to dive into the architecture of Aries Cloud Agent Python. We are willing to do it again in the afternoon. So if I could get folks, if people are interested and would want to, would much appreciate having a afternoon session as well, say 3 o'clock Pacific. If you could put a like hands up or something like that, raise hand to say you'd be interested in that, because that suits your time frame. In other words, you can't make the 8 a.m. Pacific and would appreciate another one. We would do a second one. So
it's worth noting that we could record the one that's
yeah,
going on.
Yeah, we will record the others. So right now I'm only seeing one person, two people. Anyone else? So it might not be worth doing the afternoon one and we go with the recording. Mike and Keith, we'll figure it out.
Okay.
All right.
Excellent. This is good work. By the way, BCGov team, appreciate the API token or insecure explicit options there is really particularly awesome, as well as the establishing a connection through a public DID is also a fantastic use case. So we appreciate your efforts there. I want to call this out. They've also been really great about accepting pull requests from members of the community. And so if you have fixes or additions there, then they will be responsive to that. And that's been awesome.
Yeah, one other interesting one here to highlight. I'm going to do one more, which is we now support or will soon support both the 0.1 and the 1.0 versions of issue credentials. So this is an example of deprecating one version. We'll continue to support it because we know there's a bunch of implementations in the community, and then we'll eventually get everyone moved over to the 1.0 issue credentials protocol. So that's kind of cool. We've got a PR for that Stephen Klump has done, and we'll be reviewing and merging that shortly. So that's another cool piece of work that's been done that we'll be using.
Excellent.
Quick question regarding your like versioning. What do you foresee as like your 1.0 and stuff like that? Are you just planning to do 1.0 when Aries hits active, or specifically for the entire project, not the issue credential?
Sorry, you mean the numbering of ACA, like the 020?
Yeah, yeah.
So the plan is, well, we wanted to get a version out there, so that's what the 020 is. We were given guidance that Hyperledger says 0.6 is, it's more or less done. 0.8 means the APIs are all solid, and 1.0 means that it's GA, so we'll now start to think about, now that we've got something out there, we'll start to think of, okay, what does 0.06 mean, or 0.6 mean, and then what is 0.8? That'll lead us to what 0.8 is.
Okay.
But that's kind of the plan. We just wanted to get something released and in on PyPI. Because remember, if you're building a controller, so if you're building an app on top of this, you don't need to do anything. In theory, you don't need to do anything in the agent itself. You just build a controller that controls an instance of the agent. So PyPI is the way you should be getting the code.
Yep, that makes sense. Thank you for the answer on that too.
Cool. Awesome. All right.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Next up on the release and work update is Daniel Bloom with the Aries Protocol Test Suite, which was just this morning transferred into Hyperledger as a repo.
Yeah, so I'll share my screen super fast. This is just a README. It is now transferred, as Sam said, as of this morning, so we're excited about that. I put a fair amount of time into this README, so hopefully it's good and it's clear how to operate the test suite itself, but also to add tests. This is kind of just the 0.1.0 release, I guess, and included right now are an example of just simple messaging between an agent and a statically connected agent. That's the same demo that I did a couple weeks back, I think it was, on this call. And then I've also included for continuity from the Indie Agent Test Suite, the same manual connection tests that we used during the Connectathon. So those are both in here. We anticipate that we'll be adding tests as time goes on, as more protocols reach kind of, I guess, accepted state. So yeah, I have to find Zoom.
Awesome. Excellent, Daniel. Any updates from Troy on the Aries Framework Go?
Hey, sure. Yeah, we just kicked that that new repo off, and we've started to push some commits in. So we've started with did document parsing, and we're moving on to HTTP transport and did exchange shortly.
Fantastic. So quick point of order. In the future, we're not going to just simply carry everything over from previous. What we'd like to do is have people come. We may reach out periodically, but if you have updates that you're willing to share, we'd like to have you add yourself to the list of upcoming releases and work updates. We know that there won't be movement on every project, you know, every time we have a meeting. And so we want to, but we do want to publish and make obvious the work that is going on so that folks can get involved and keep a pulse on the community. So a bit of an interstitial there, but Daniel, we also had some updates to the Aries SDK Python. Would you be willing to talk about that just briefly?
Yes. Let's see. So it was mostly just things needed for the protocol test suite. So we could pull the Aries SDK Python in as a dependency for that. And it's basically just kind of another wrapper around Indy right now. But it does some of the convenient stuff of JSON dumping and loading for us. So it's a lot less repetitive in the Python code.
Right. And the goal there is to swap that out with the Aries SDK when we get there.
Right.
For doing that stuff. So in there, and you, did you mention that you had published a version of that to PyPI?
I forgot to mention that. So there is now a published version of that on PyPI. Yep.
Fantastic. Okay. Richard, is there, we already covered the meeting a little bit. Is there anything else to mention about the Indy SDK, Aries SDK split merge transition fund?
Not about the split or transition. We are working on a bug fix release for July. So no big deal there. I did have a question about the Aries Framework Go. Do we still see a need for an Aries SDK Go, or does the framework replace that and we can get rid of the SDK repo?
My inclination is that even if we don't have anything in it yet, it's a little early to be whacking stuff that we don't yet have additions for. So I think the framework work should go forward. And then if someone, feels the need to create a Go level, SDK, then that certainly has a place in that repo. Any other opinions?
So I understand the idea that we're not doing language wrappers on the SDK level anymore. So that makes sense to drop some of those language level wrappers. But I also agree with Sam that we don't want to drop anything prematurely. And I think we want to make sure that's one of the reasons why we want collaboration around the migration of the SDK itself, because that will help make it more clear what we need to do next afterwards.
Right. So I think the long answer, Richard, is that, yeah, we may need to kill that. I think that we should not be hasty in doing so right now, though.
That's fine. I just wanted to know what people are thinking.
Okay. And then any updates on URSA? That we brought that up sort of, it's kind of in two related places here. Any future release information on URSA?
I kind of mentioned it already on this morning's meeting. Just that their non-creds 2.0 stuff is starting, they're starting to be PRs for it. If you want to find more about it, go to the URSA docs repo and there's specs written for it. That's all.
Okay. Excellent. Okay, is there any other getting started stuff that we should bring up before we drop into our main topics? I love, by the way, hearing about work that's going on and the forward progress that we're making. And so I appreciate those that are willing to share work updates with what's going on. Anything else before we move along? Okay, if you got here just a tiny bit late, we're talking about RFCs that we think should progress or through the process, and so please add them to this document if you think you've got some. I've got a couple here in the beginning. We don't have to go in order necessarily, but I know there's some topics around data exchange in particular, and we want to talk about any issues that are still open on these and so that we can resolve them and move them along the RFC process. First one that I'd like to talk about, it just occurred to me that I'm not sharing and no one can see my screen. Here we go. The first one that I'd like to talk about is the DIT exchange. This is the old connection protocol. And there's at least one topic that relates to this. The complicated piece about this one is that actually relates to several other RFCs and topics. And in particular, we have when you send an exchange response, this talks about signing this response. And the idea here was that we would mimic the signing of updates as they would happen in the peer DID related update protocols. And there's been a lot of movement on those. And so I don't exactly know where this lands. I also think that the concept of signing a field has slightly melted away. Do we have a replacement RFC for that original hype?
Yeah, it's 0066. And I'm actually planning to merge them all together. Because there's been some discussion about changing the JWE format to make it fully compliant. And so I want to just make everything fit into one common RFC for the cryptographic layer.
Right. So this is dependent a bit on that, as well as any patterns on how we're doing signatures on in the peer DID spec. Daniel Hardman, do you have any thoughts about that as it relates to this?
So in the peer DID spec, we are signing a unit of change against a document. And that unit of change is, the signature has to be on something smaller than a message. If we put the signature on the message itself, that would actually express the right, like the sender of the message is endorsing the full message. That's not the problem. The problem is that we have to be able to save off the subset of the message that represents the delta and keep it with the persisted data that we have about the DID document. And when we do that, we have to have the signature with it. So we need a signature that's not associated just with the Uber context of a message, but rather some subset thereof. I need to be able to point to a specific JSON object inside a document and say that object is what got signed.
So that's similar to this, where we have the connection that needs to be. The interesting part about this is that the signature, or the signing key is not necessarily the signing key of the thing that sent the message, but it's the key that was present in the initial invitation. And that way you can be sure that it's more or less an authorized connection block. So it sounds to me like we have similar problems, but we don't necessarily want to parallel the pure did spec exactly.
Well, I think that what the pure did spec needs and what you need here are close enough to the same thing that we should describe the solution with a single mechanism, namely, how do you sign something that's other than the full scope of a message?
And I fully agree there. Specifically, what I mean, though, is that the change semantics of the pure did method are different from this bootstrapping process of a did exchange.
That's true.
And so that I think we should not worry about paralleling because they're solving two very different problems. But you're right. The signature thing is important to both of us and making sure that we resolve that.
So when you guys say that, do you mean like the signature decorator?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think
that's what I mean. Is that what you mean, Daniel?
Yes.
Okay. I've intentionally left that stuff off right now just because I see similarities, but I think there's some better like API design that we can do. But using Andrew's suggestion, I think it's going to come out to be like very similar where like the frameworks are implementing a lot of this stuff. And then we just have a generic signature thing in like Ursa.
So Daniel, I'm sorry. So do you have a solution or you're still considering a solution? It wasn't clear to me.
Well, we had a solution when we were using the indie hype that Kyle originally wrote. But that hype is kind of in flux right now. So when a replacement for the old document comes online, I assume it will continue to have the same features and we will use it. And that will be our solution. But I haven't seen it yet. So I'm a little bit unconfident of my answer.
Okay. So I solved this problem once before, but probably not in the same way, just by having an encoded string. And then you just have a signature with an encoded string that can be unserialized to a JSON object.
That's what we've done. That's the same pattern, but the question is how much that's likely to change, or if we can proceed with something as a stopgap, Kyle, where we do that, or we basically take the same signature decorator spec that we had before, and bring it over with the understanding that we may want to improve it in the future.
So if we do a stopgap solution, are we fine with breaking changes?
Depends what you mean by breaking change. For example, is it going to use a different at type here? Sure, that's easy because we could just detect a different type and then move along with something else.
I could design it in such a way. And then we could say that the what is in the current indie hype is the stopgap solution until I come up with something that I like better.
Right. So we could bring it over and say, hey, here's sort of the version one. And if we do it so that we have an easy differentiator, then yes, I have no problem with everything else about what's showing here being totally different. So long as we have an easy way to tell the difference between, you know, the old way and the new way.
Yeah, I'll just do like a versioning or something like that. I'll just make it like 2.0. And my guess is I may not be changing this JSON format at all. I'm just going to be changing how APIs are designed.
Which is fine, but this will let us move forward. We had to get to the previous connection protocol. We had the same issue where there was we had to sort of get several things in place in order to rely upon them. And so if we could, I wonder if it's worth actually moving the hype over into an RFC more or less as is, so that we can point to it in the Aries repos and when we're doing so, and that will help us move forward. And then we have a future revision that comes along.
Yeah, that's probably the best solution. There's going to be some stuff that needs to be removed from it because it was trying to do both decorators and full message signing together. And I would prefer that what's moved is just the decorator stuff.
That's a good point. And I think that's what we're looking for right now is just decorator stuff.
Okay. Yes. I will try and get something in the next few weeks. I am moving, so I don't know how that's going to play into stuff.
Okay. Hey, for people who are listening in on this, I just want to make a meta comment in case you're a little bit puzzled. Why do we have both a signature on a message and the concept of a signature on something inside a message? And I want to explain it this way. In Git, you have the possibility of submitting a commit and saying the author of this commit is actually Fred over there, but I'm just committing it for him. And in the same way in DIDCOM messages, the sender of a message needs the ability to sign a message and say, yeah, I really sent this. But parts of a message may come from some other party. And if that other party needs to prove that they in fact endorse that particular content, that's when you need a decorator, is to say, here's the signature around this content, which is different from the signature around the sender, the signature supplied by the sender of a message. Hope that is helpful. Maybe it just made things worse. If so, I apologize.
No, I think that's useful, Daniel, within that context. And so, Kyle, you're right. While you're pursuing the message signing stuff, which is good work, by the way, let's just do the decorator part. And that way it sort of clears up the connection protocol, which is really helpful from a basic understanding.
Are you still looking to use the signature decorator in the connection protocol?
Yes.
I would suggest we do a full signature. Or sign the full message.
You can't for exactly the reason I just said.
We can't, because the key that needs to be used for the signing is not the key of the sender, but the key present in the invitation.
Okay, you lost me there, but I don't think that detail needs to be extrapolated right now. Like, we don't need to go down that hole. I'll follow up with you on that.
Yeah, I'll follow you up, but there's actually a sane reason why that needs to be the case. We can't just sign the whole message.
A meta question for the meta comment. Is there any particular limitation to the data payload in something like this?
No.
In terms of size? No.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Not that it doesn't already exist in terms of passing a large message.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Another comment? Is that you, Kyle?
Tim, can you hear me? No.
Yes, we can. Tobias.
So I guess the only other question I've got around the current state of DID Exchange, I haven't reviewed it recently, but have we got sufficient commentary around secure invitations versus insecure invitations now that we have in place non-repudiation as a valid format at the envelope level of DIDCOM? I wonder whether or not it's worth drawing attention to secure versus insecure invitations. I guess that's probably not the right word to use for distinction. But signed versus unsigned invitations, I think, is warrants some discussion, because to me, I think that's going to be a really good way to build potential trust or pre-context when someone is deciding whether or not to connect with an invite.
When would you ever want an unsigned plaintext message or plaintext invitation? Or am I
unsigned plaintext?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, I'm saying like, when you've got a peer-to-peer, you've got two individuals and neither of them have public DIDs, you could have a signed invitation, but the signer might not be known in any context. But if you have a bank that has generated a invitation and sent it via email, when a mobile app scans that, if that's signed by a public DID, then the mobile app is capable of, if there is a web of trust behind that, the public credentials about that DID available, then you can build context for the user.
So there's a couple of, let me interject here real quick.
Yeah,
there's a couple of variations in the invitations that can be sent, right? So here's an invitation with a public DID, and you'll notice that there's no endpoint or routing keys in there because you're expected to resolve the DID and pull that out of their service block. We also then, what we're more talking about is keys that have an inline endpoint and keys here, and this is where it really comes up to is that there's nothing that helps necessarily sign this message or the invitation as it's passed. And the invitation is an out-of-band consideration. It is not passed over didcoms. So typically it's in a URL or it's in a QR code or something of that nature. And what Tobias is talking about is adding a signature to this to prevent any manipulation of the invitation along the way.
But it's a signature from a third party, as I understand it, which means that you're basically re-centralizing around third parties, similar to what
No, hold on. I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying, so you look at the invitation with a public invitation message with a public did. The envelope that should be prepared in should be a signed, unencrypted envelope. So, and it should be signed with a key that is present in that public did, which means you can have confidence that the invitation is actually going to that, well, the subject of that did was actually in fact the person who generated the invitation. And then if that did's public and I can resolve that against some public credential registries, then I could discover information about that before I make a decision whether or not to respond to the invite.
So Tobias, can you outline the value provided by having a did versus having a did that's signed by the key present in the did?
So what I'm pointing out is that invitation message, that public invitation did there, if that was wrapped in an, if that was just a plain text message and it wasn't signed and encrypted, then that's just an invitation for spam, because anyone can generate invitations for any other public did, and then someone will connect to them, and like you're essentially just got an unchained like way of generating invitations for other people to connect.
So that's actually like, by design, and it's highlighted in here that you can take a did and not in place of actually being explicitly handed an invitation, you can take a public did and then attempt to connect to it, and that's actually a feature we want.
So you don't want the person being connected to have any option about, so the connection request would be the point in which they block the spam. So if they didn't want a connection from a party for any reason, then they would reject it at that point.
That's correct.
So it's okay to accept insecure invitations.
Well, there's nothing, the only thing that you could manipulate here is actually the label, which is an untrusted label anyway, which means that that if you manipulated the did, it's going to point to a different did, and there's nothing else to that you could actually manipulate about this particular one. And so
can I comment on that?
Sure.
Because I think this, what Tab is talking about is the situation as, for example, WhatsApp or other applications doing, that they are sending a message to you saying that this guy invited you for a conversation, but actually he didn't. They are just sending an invitation to both of you. If one of them will accept it, then so basically they are forcing you to get into interaction. And I think that's the spam which he is talking about, that actually you can do that for anybody and send out from one application invitation to 100,000 people saying that they supposed to connect and force some kind.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to sort of point out is, that I think there's two permutations here. One is a secure and an insecure invitation, basically.
So I think secure and insecure, I understand what you're getting at, but I think we're using
on where you see the trust boundary.
Well,
I think it's more solicited versus unsolicited communication.
Yes.
Well, signed or verified, I'm not sure.
But the signature in this case is actually more useful to when the request is sent, not by the person who's evaluating the invitation. Because then they can say, hey, this is someone that I actually asked to connect with me by sending them an invitation, as opposed to someone that just created an invitation using a public did. I'll highlight a couple things. It has an effect with public dids because peer dids are not going to have this problem. You're not going to be able to resolve it or discover it anyway, which means that we don't have the same spam problem with a peer did. The second issue is that it's constrained to specifically people that have public dids that can be discovered and people making up their own invitation. So there's two. Kyle asked earlier, why on earth would you want an unsolicited invitation or an unsolicited connection request? Very specifically, if you desire to connect to someone who issued the issuer of a credential, for example, in order to get credentials from them, let's say, like, hey, here's a degree credential. Please prove to me that you are qualified to issue degree credentials. That's what we're talking about. And so we need the ability to have an unsolicited connection to a public DID. And what Tobias is talking about is the case where you would want a way of verifying that it is in fact a solicited invitation instead of an unsolicited one.
So that makes sense. However, I would argue that you still don't need an unsolicited invitation, because if it's a public DID, you can just discover the public DID and send a connection request. You don't even need an invite. I'm not sure what purpose the unsolicited invitation is doing. It's going to lull people potentially into a false sense of security around, oh, I received an invitation from DID XYZ. I can just see it as a mechanism by which developers can be misled. I've received an invitation, I've decoded an invitation. There's no security around that invitation or solicitation around it. So that's...
I think the good analogy could be with the email, that I can send an email under your name and someone can see that, okay, it was sent by you, but actually if you will dive into the header of the email, you can figure out that actually it was not. So this is more or less the same, that you put the signature on this invitation as an envelope, that you can be sure that it was sent whoever is controlling that bit. So you can avoid the spam.
So as it is, this data exchange protocol assumes that invitations are out of band and the security is subject to the method of passing it. For example, if you're generating a QR code on the screen of your phone, anyone who can see the screen of your phone can read that. So the question that the core of the question I think you're bringing up, Tobias, is that, is it worth preventing the advancement of this protocol in order to erase that that expectation that the out-of-band security is not within the scope of it, or can we proceed as is and then add that later? I think that's the fundamental question that you're asking.
Yeah, and it comes down to where we define when trust is like, because we've talked about the notion in this community for quite a while that connections are trustless and verifiable credentials should be the data that are passed post-connection in order to build trust in context. But I just wonder whether or not simple measures for a whole body of use cases right at the invitation phase can...
For me, can I jump in here for a second? I don't know if it's me that's breaking up or you, Tobias, but I'm not hearing you very well. Can I just make a comment? I think that Tobias's mindset is the one that's compelling to me. And the reason why is that I think there will be things besides exchanging DIDs where a signature on a plain text message might be desirable. And so having the DID exchange protocol allow that on the invitation feels like a very parallel and natural sort of feature. Saying that we can't put a signature on the invitation feels like an artificial constraint. And I think if I were a company, I might publish to the world an invitation to connect and sign my invitation so that the world could tell that it is a real invitation from me. I might not say, look, there's lots of different invitations to connect out there that all purport to come from Acme Corporation. But once you get another step into the protocol, you'll be able to tell which one is real. I would rather right at the beginning specify which invitation is really coming from me.
Well, I mean, the thing that comes to mind right away are things like, you know, lead gen activities or even, you know, like radio contests, right? You know, the next 50 people who, you know, send in this, you know, gets a t-shirt.
Yeah. And Steve has asked in chat, can signatures be optional? Yes. Nobody's saying you must do a signature. We're saying that it should be valid to do a signature on a plain text invitation. And the reason for that is to unambiguously identify who the sender of the invitation is, even before you can encrypt it for a specific party. And that, to me, it just boils down to the fact that repudiation and tamper evidence, which are the things associated with signatures, and encryption are often things that go together, but they are not things that must go together, and we should allow them to be used independently. Now, I do agree with Kyle's statement that it doesn't make a lot of sense to have a plain text invitation without a signature, but I still would allow it. There might be cases that we haven't thought of where it makes more sense than I'm realizing. Like maybe instead of the signature, you get the assurance because you're in a cave 400 feet underground doing a peer-to-peer protocol with your friend, and you know that your friend is the one sending it to you because you're the only two people that could possibly be getting this Bluetooth signal. So I don't want to constrain it too hard, I guess is my summary.
So I like the idea of signing, and I think that we can do it both with both public dids, and it would also work for a peer did invitation simply by using the associated key out of a recipient key to actually sign the thing. I have two practical concerns. One is that QR codes are the standard way of passing this, and I think that we can rapidly get into having something too large to have a scannable QR code. The other practical reason is more or less just we haven't really nailed this down yet. We don't really have a signature envelope at this point.
So the other thing I'd like to raise that public invitations that are signed with public dids adds an opportunity to actually create the context in a secure manner required to inform a user in a mobile app. So right now that label is self-attested. And I mean, our customer testing's told us that people put false trust in logos and names all the time. And so if you are presenting an invite in a mobile app as, you know, such and such is here to connect with you, if you have no way of doing any form of validation checking around that, it is going to be an invitation to misleading consumers, I guess. And so if you have a signed invitation with a public did, and if you resolve that did and there is information linked to it through verifiable credentials and credential registries, then the information you can actually put up in the mobile app can have some form of confidence and certainty by the wallet vendor. And so, because at the moment, most of our UIs feature logos and names right at the invitation phase. How are we actually doing that? How are we making that decision? Does anyone
Well, what the UI should be saying, if we did the UI right from a cybersecurity perspective, is somebody wants to connect with you, and right now they're claiming that a good label for this connection is foo. It remains to be seen whether that's a good label. You should immediately check their bona fides after you connect with them. But I'm sure that our UIs aren't actually being that precise.
I guess that nuance would be lost on most users as well. So,
I agree that it's a problem and it should be explicit. We should have a mode where we don't accept invitations without a second factor. And that should be a setting so that, you know, the user has to explicitly, you know, do that. And the default is that they send an invitation, you don't accept it, and you tell the user you've received an invitation. We're waiting for you to confirm in whatever second factor the app is set up for that confirmation, whether it's a phone call, a text, an in-person, or some other thing, then the user, it knows that they have to do that. Otherwise, you know, they're warned that it's bad for them.
So I think that second factors push to a sort of another level and not really solve the core problem. I think that Tobias is right that credentials can solve the problem. I'm leery that trying to include the credentials either in a public did, in the public did document or a reference to the credential, or in the invitation itself is problematic. But what I do think is possible is that you could send a message without exchanging dids you could send a message to the endpoint and say, please provide me a credential of valid identifier or whatever. And you might have a list of issuers, for example, maybe the Better Business Bureau in the United States would do this. They would actually certify that your logo is your logo, and consequently that other people are not spoofing your logo in the same credentials that they're handing out. And then that would be a credential with a logo and a name that you could actually display. And that would be in a handshake after your, after you have the information, but before you fully exchange DIDs to decide whether you're going to accept it or not.
But you'd still want
the invitation a little bit cleaner and simpler.
But you'd still want to sign it. Otherwise, you're just going to get spammed invitations.
Sure. Yeah. We are assuming we're assuming that case. But the spam issue and the verified other party, right? The logo and the name for the other party are two orthogonal issues.
Yeah, I thought I was interpreting the argument that signing doesn't do any good, so we should just not sign, and signing solves the spam issues. So you should sign even if you're not doing two-factor authentication.
Yes. So there's also an interesting option that we haven't explored before, where an invitation could actually have an identifying payload created by the issuer that gets passed back as part of the protocol, so that there is a point of correlation by the inviter, that they can use to apply to the invitation when it's accepted, and a signature would also help that. I'm buying the arguments that signatures can be useful. So Steve, you've got your hand up in the interface. Is that on purpose, Steve McCown?
Yes, just good. Want to make an observation that when we're talking about adding two-factor authentication on top of DIDs and signatures and everything, is that getting out of our use case? I mean, aren't we wanting to use the crypto to not have to do two-factor?
Yes, I would argue the same thing. I don't want to punt the problem somewhere else. I would rather solve it using the mechanisms we have in the ecosystem. Here's the question. The connection protocol is fairly foundational to making connections and making stuff work. What are the next steps that we need to do to get this to a point where it's community acceptable and move it along? There's the signed invitations is one topic. And then we have the self-attested label. The reason why we didn't support an image is that I feel like the higher fidelity the identifier we present, the more tempting it is to believe it. The self-attested nature, I'm reluctant to try and nail all of this down in this sort of this first rev of this, simply because I'd like to get it moving and then improve it rather than making sure it's perfect before we start.
So the only other piece that I wanted to discuss was that we have that service decorator with invitation message there with keys and URL endpoint. Is that going to be re-encapsulated into that service decorator, or are we going to have those in line? And if we really wanted to run up a spike of discussion is if we are using the service decorator, then are we making certain decorators mandatory?
The answer is the service decorator should be used here because that's really in line. That was still not resolved yet, which is why it hadn't backpropagated to this. But yes, the format should be changed there, but that's a pretty minor change. The big floating issue around service decorators was how to specify the key type and format with inline keys. And we have to use inline keys at least for some of this in order to make the protocol work. So that was the remaining issue there. But no, I should have gone through and converted these to service decorators, and I will do so.
As far as I know, Tobias, the question of whether a decorator is mandatory is not a global question. It's a protocol scoped question. So in the scope of the DID exchange protocol, yes, the service decorator would be mandatory. That doesn't mean it's mandatory all over the place. Yeah. So it's up to every protocol we need a decorator in this place, and this is what it should be.
Does every implementation have to recognize all decorators, though?
They have to recognize whatever decorators are required by the protocols they claim to support.
Yes. So, for example, if you have an implementation that implements the data exchange protocol, and the data exchange protocol says here you have to understand the service decorator, then yes, they'd have to implement the service decorator in order to make that happen, in order to fully support the data exchange protocol.
So this is not unlike the phenomenon that happens in programming with mixins. If you're dealing with some particular point in a class hierarchy somewhere, and you point to that class and say, this is the kind of class object that I need when you call this function, and that's all you say, then you haven't said anything about any mixins. But if you say, well, I want a particular class that also has the following trait mixed into it when you call this function, now you've defined in the API that you've created that you need to know more information. And it's not really any different. It's still a decorator in the sense that you can add it or subtract it to different messages. And if you're an implementer of a particular protocol and you don't want to generally understand how a service could show up in lots of different places, you can just treat service as a specially named attribute of the particular message type that you like. But you do need to understand service, or else you haven't really understood the protocol.
So there's some variations that treating it at a protocol level help. And one of them, for example, is that if you have an inline DID like this, there's actually no reason to have a service decorator. That's one of the differences between, you know, an invitation based on a public DID and one that isn't. So yes. Any further questions about service decorators? I just need to do the work to adapt this for that.
Does that make this a breaking change?
Does anyone have
any? Some people are already supporting this.
No one is actually supporting the DID exchange protocol right here.
I thought that's what Steven was just raising in the Aries maintainer channel. Was that?
Well, he mentioned that the protocol name changed and wanted to talk about it, and I was going to get to that topic in just a second. Okay. So the other question to get back to is, we have service decorators. Is there any further comment about service decorators?
The only point I would like to raise is, has anyone got any thoughts about how to solve the issue of an inline key block that contains the cryptographic material required? So that currently, to summarize the problem at the moment, we're talking about inline keys, and that inline key in that array there, you can see
Tobias, I suspect you're breaking up a bit. It's
okay. Do you want to relay that point and see whether or not anyone has any thoughts on that, Sam?
Yeah, so I didn't hear exactly what you said, but let me give it an attempt based on our previous conversations. And this may be worth talking about service decorators very specifically, but the problem is that when you are going to declare an inline service block, because you have not yet exchanged a DID document, you have to include keys. But we don't have a way of specifying for each key, for each inline key, what the format is of the key and the type of the key. And so there's two kind of lines of thought. One is that we additionally include an inline keys block, so that we could then refer to those keys here, and the keys blocks could actually detail the different types of things. The second option, which I will probably make developers panic, is that this thing can either be a string, or it can be a structure, and the structure then would include the type information and the key information like that. The third option is that we come up with a standard prefixing type of syntax, so that you can specify as part of a prefix to the string what its type and format is. And in doing so, then we would have more information about each of these keys. To get to this point, there's a standing assumption about the type and format of these keys. There is a desire with the service decorator to keep as close as possible to the format of a service block inside of a DID document itself, in order to enable simpler processing between the two. And maybe that's a false goal. Maybe we shouldn't be pursuing that, but that was the original goal of that effort.
Have you ever thought about using JSON web keys to represent the keys, actually?
They're just really large. And so we struggle a little bit with the fact that we're trying to shove this all into a QR code at some point. And so we have talked about that, but we sort of didn't conclude upon anything like that just because of the sheer size of the encoding.
Okay.
Just to be clear, multi-hash. The invitation message is a unique beast. All of the other messages in all the other protocols that I know about assume that you have DIDCOM capabilities, but the invitation uniquely assumes nothing of the sort. It assumes that you're sending basically just a URL to some other party who has no software capable of processing anything other than a URL. And because of that assumption, a number of interesting constraints get introduced. It needs to be small. It needs to be interpretable by a web browser and some other things. And if you aren't familiar with that and you're throwing out suggestions about how to make the invitation more robust and stuff, I get it, but probably not going to work because the invitation deliberately doesn't have many of the capabilities that the other steps in the protocol have.
I'm suspecting we need a deeper conversation specifically around the service block in order to really draw these things out. I mean, we could do that next, but I don't want to monopolize all of the time with this particular RFC.
Just wanted to ask, did you consider using multi-hashes for a description of any kind of crypto within those messages?
We're not encrypting these.
No, not encrypting, but basically describing the what kind of keys are used, like type and algorithms and stuff.
I don't know that we have, but I've added it to my list.
The DID doc, or excuse me, the DID specification already has a canonical inventory of key types, Robert. So using multi-hash would actually be non-compliant with the DID spec.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point.
I've taken it off my list. Thank you,
Well,
Daniel.
I don't think that multi-hash is a crazy idea. I just think for this particular problem, I'm not sure that actually helps us, but anyway.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm content to come back to the to talk about this more directly and to figure this out. And I should probably try and raise this in an issue and to be able to drill this down in for the service decorator, because that would help solve this particular problem. The other, and there's a variety of options given the unique nature of this that we don't have to be general per se. We might be able to solve some very specific problems and narrow the constraints in order to make some forward progress in the short term. So the other blocking thing, we have the self-attested label, which is another discussion. We've talked about signing this invitation, and there seems like a large desire to make some progress on that.
I think Johnny Crunch had something. I know he raised Q Plus like about 30 minutes ago.
Yeah, that was for something else. But I think just to point out, so the multi-hash, but multi-codex actually does have a raw field. So you can actually, if you want to inline the byte representation of the key, there is a way of doing that with multi-codex.
So Johnny, I haven't known about multi-codex. I've known about multi-base and multi-hash. Is multi-codex part of the same multi-formats initiative?
Yes. Yes, it is. Okay. But it's basically the way we prepend a description that is an Ethereum block or Bitcoin transaction, but also you can just put raw bytes in there. And there is actually we've been working on multi-key for a while too. It's hard to chase that. But there is, if you want to do raw inline, there is a multi-codec to represent that.
Okay, interesting.
I've added that to my list of things to look at. So having a signed invitation seems like a relevant thing. Kyle, this relates, seems like most to your work of having a signature envelope.
Yes.
Is that true? How do we move forward trying to apply a signature envelope to an invitation to see what that would look like?
I already have demos documented in the 0066. I think I just took like one of these invitations directly.
Isn't it really just adding some commentary to this DidExchange RFC that says you can use either the signed or unsigned envelope?
Maybe. We got to go make sure. I mean, I haven't looked at 0066 at all. Go find it here real quick.
If you're going to allow signing or not signing to be optional, then you have to discuss whether a recipient can silently drop an invitation without responding and saying, sign it, that's why I'm dropping it.
You can always drop any DIDCOM message because you can't do otherwise. I mean, there's no way to enforce response in DIDCOM.
Okay, so if you don't get an invite, they just you just the inviter just keeps sending the invites. If you don't get a response,
they can. It's possible to return an error report, but that's not something that I want to attempt to resolve at this point. That's okay. A nice problem to solve later.
So you can throttle it by returning an error report, and if they're well behaved, then they'll stop sending the invite. But somebody who's DDoSing you will just keep sending it.
You can also just have your, have whatever software sits in front of you stop receiving communication from a particular IP address or a particular DID. You don't have to even know that it's an invitation before you filter it.
Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah, scroll down. There you go.
Yeah. So, no, okay.
Here's my problem with this, Kyle. Is that I'm looking, this first of all, this is a little hard to read, but I'm looking for an easy way to identify the fact that this is a signature envelope as opposed to an encryption envelope or a plain text message.
They're both Yoast. They're both valid. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kyle, but they're both valid Yoast formats, and you just have to make a decision at the very start. This is why I think all DIDCOM messages should have the most outer structure. I think unsigned, unencrypted envelopes should have a Yoast structure and just say, not signed, no encrypted. And then you.
Do you mean Jose? By the way?
Yes. Yes, Jose.
Okay. I was tripping up there for a second. Okay, so you're saying they're both Jose, and because they're both Jose, we should be able to use Jose semantics to figure out which is which.
Correct, and I think all unsigned stuff should also be. I mean, all unsigned, unencrypted should also be Jose, or some structure, outer structure that at least gives us that uniform passing logic.
Well, we're not yet talking about necessarily passing agent messages raw, if you will. And so, if we did, we could come up with something that follows the same structure but is just plain text.
There's not anything within the Jose standard for leaving things unencrypted and unsigned. It is a signing and encryption suite.
Serializing.
Right. I know. And I find essentially what Jose is really is JSON notation with signing and encryption on top of it. And so I'm just wondering whether or not at that level, at that envelope level, if we had semantics that are uniform for all DIDCOM messages, signed, unsigned, encrypted, then all DIDCOM messages would go through the same parser and essentially a context or properties would spit out and say, I was able to decrypt it in XYZ, or I was able to recover the signature of X, or nothing was yielded when I passed this.
That's what the unpack functionality with the new API design is doing. Yeah. If you take a look at like DIDCOM.js, it's outputting that type of detail to it. But I did not explicitly include the plain text unsigned stuff because I saw no purpose for it. And I think there's more potential for abuse than there is for features and advantages.
Do we think the passing of all didelimited messages
triple dot delimited?
What's that?
Is this the compact encoding? The Jose content compact encoding. It's the triples that are not delimited.
Yeah.
So is this what we're proposing that we pass as the actual message? That would avoid us having to re-encrypt it in some other way. This is already URL safe.
Yep. So it's just outputting a compact JWS. And if you're doing only signing, that's what it'll output. But if you're doing like a non-repeatable authenticated message, it'll take that string in there and it'll stick it inside a JWE as the message.
Right. And so if we're designing something that can take, there is an argument to not to simply change the data exchange protocol so that everything is signed, and so there would be no form of direct, because you're right, if you have a DID, you don't actually have to create your own invitation before you operate on it. You can just you can just use the information you retrieve out of a DID document to send a request. So what we could do, this is a change that we could do, is we could change it to be the only valid form for the connection protocol is to take create an invitation message, and then you sign it in this format, whether it is a public DID or a private DID. You would sign it in this format, and then you would transfer that as the payload. So and that would be simpler, meaning we have some text here about how to create the invitation string, blah, 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 and then you pack it into a URL. We would change it so that this is the compact JWS of an invitation and all invitations are signed. If we did it, it would remove some complexity about having two separate options and also make the parsing a lot easier, because every invitation you get is a JWS that contains an invitation message. And you don't have to worry about any other variant.
That makes sense. Yeah. And I think formally this could be called a JWT, because JWTs can also include encryption at some point, which is the direction I'm looking to head.
Yes. I'm going to keep saying JWS because I don't want people to confuse it with other uses of JWT that don't align with this.
Okay.
And since JWS is technically still valid. So what I'm going to do then is I'm going to experiment with what it would be like if we actually went ahead and did this. If we fully changed it, the format, so there was nothing except. Is anyone opposed to the idea of this? I know, Daniel, you mentioned over-constraining it. And we can certainly come up with an alternative if we need an unsigned version. I think that could be a very valid way of making this go forward.
I'm not opposed to moving it. The two variants that I think are the most compelling are signed encrypted and just signed but not encrypted. The variant where it's unsigned and unencrypted, if we don't support that, I think there might be some use cases we'll eventually dream up, but for the time being, I'm not too worried about them. For good measure, I think there's three modes of communication that are common and kind of right down the middle of the road with DIDCOM, which are the two that I said were valid in this case, plus a third one, which is, so there's signed and encrypted, there's just signed, and then there's just encrypted. Those three are going to be common in DIDCOM. And I don't think that unsigned and unencrypted communication in general has much place in DIDCOM.
So what we would be doing is we would take the one weird exception, which is the invitation message, which is passed out of band, and it would be signed, not encrypted, but it would be signed from the get-go, and there would be no plaintext version of this. So what I can do is take this that direction and come up with the modifications necessary, perhaps make some tests. I want to do some size analysis to make sure that we can still pull this off within a reasonably scannable QR code, and try to move it that direction. And that would solve the signature. And we can potentially solve the service decorator problem. The last thing that we haven't really gotten to is the self-attested label or other on-screen identifier. And I think that that might, for the meantime, be out of scope until we have credentials in a better state where we like them. Any comments on that?
Yeah, I think so. Sam Smith put some good comments on this. And I'm largely agreeing with what he said, which is I feel like we're conflating the two by sticking the label in there. The idea of verification of the identity versus just exchange of keys.
We went through this notion of the label. We debated it at least three times, and I'm getting a little bit frustrated about it, guys. The label is not trusted. And I'm sorry if people think that that's a security risk, but we cannot remove the label because then if you get seven different invitations, you can't tell them apart. You have to have some basis for reasoning about invitations that's not keys.
And I fully understand that, and I agree with that point. And what it comes down to for me is if we're all interpreting it that way, then it's going to be used in that way. It's going to be used in a trusted way.
So what would be your proposed alternative, Kyle? Give me a reasonable alternative and I'll vote for it. But nobody gives any reasonable alternatives. They just say, let's get rid of it.
So we do have an ID in the connection invitation as well. Mm-hmm. So that is a source of uniqueness that you could rely, but you could rely on.
Uniqueness doesn't matter. It's a user interface question. You can't go with no reference to anything. You have to have something. I just don't see how you can have nothing. I agree that from a user experience, you should put a big red flag on it saying, this has not been verified. This connection has not been verified. You know, just like you have in, you know, the lock icon on your browser. It's open as big as you want, and you should. That's what we plan on intending. That's what we wanted to do in our previous demos. But, you know, you got to have something. I agree completely with Daniel. You can't not have anything on an invite.
Can I have a question about that part? Like, what is exactly the flow for it? Like, I receive an invitation, and I can accept it without looking into the DIT or without doing anything with it? Or do I have to resolve the DIT to actually verify that the invitation is the one which I'm expecting to be, and then verify it with some credentials, resolve stuff, and so on?
Depending on your business case, you want to do some sort of verifiable credential verification before you actually trust it. You have to figure out at what level do you want to trust your connection. If it's okay that you get a random connection from somebody, that's fine. You can ignore that. But if you get a connection, you now have a connection, and now you want to use that connection to do a verifiable credential exchange or some other mechanism to determine who the person is you're talking to and whether you trust them enough for a transaction. And the mechanism, you know, but you have to establish the connection first in order to carry on with the conversation.
I think part of this problem is actually solved by having some very clear recommendations about how user interfaces should treat these connections that we're talking about. A connection sounds like a really official thing. And it's very much not. It's literally a secure connection between that you're using for communicating securely. Just like I can go to any website and it'll establish a TLS connection with it. And I don't necessarily trust the website yet. And they may not know who I am, but now we have a secure way to talk to establish that. And so I think that establishing some very clear guidelines about what that actually means would be a really useful thing, including the fact that if this technical protocol actually happens, I still might not show the user they have a connection. It might still be shown as a pending connection, despite the fact that I've established cryptographic trust. Then what we do is we have other protocols for credential exchange and other things on top of that before I decide to, air quote, accept that connection. And what that means is that I'm going to move it in my UI from the list of pending connections or possible connections over to the list of accepted connections or whatever groups I've assigned them in or however I've associated that connection. And that's actually one of the reasons why, one of the remaining topics that we haven't yet covered was that originally this was called the connection or the connections protocol. And we changed it. I changed it as the author of this to be the DID exchange protocol. And the reason I did is because exchanging DIDs itself is the mechanical thing that you're doing here. You're not is, you know, deciding to trust it, or you're not creating this business relationship or connect anything at all. All you're doing is exchanging DIDs and bootstrapping cryptographic trust across the connection.
It's very analogous to hitting some random website and going through the Diffie-Hellman exchange that negotiates a TLS session key. That's not the same thing as trusting the website. It could still be distributing malware to you and whatever. All you've done is you've created a pipe that you can talk to that party and only that party through. And so all of these other things that we're throwing out are misunderstandings of what the goal is. We're not trying to establish any higher trust in this protocol. Once this protocol is done, you can then work on establishing trust by using credentials or whatever you want, using second factor authentication. But this protocol is not about that. It's just about trading DIDs in a way that eavesdroppers can't interfere with. And it's the very analogous goal to doing a Diffie-Hellman exchange where you have third parties that might be watching over the wire and you still end up with a secret that the other parties don't know.
And I will argue that actually in that context, because from the user perspective, we have recently discussed exactly that issue within our use cases. The secure communication, in our opinion, should be completely transparent from the user interface, user experience, right? The user is not aware of those technicalities which is happening in the background, right? And he wants trust, just a secure connection with someone. He needs to do some other operation to actually get involved into it, right? So our assumption was that basically this secure communication will happen anyway, so you don't need to have any label, and the label comes a little bit later when actually the exchange of the credentials will happen that the user can refer
to. So Robert, if you had exactly that assumption on the internet today, you would not be allowed to have any domain names associated with any of the websites that you're talking to, because you would say, well, you don't need to know that there's a domain name associated with this website. I'll just go to some random IP address. And once I get there, then after I trust the secure connection, they can tell me what their domain name is.
I agree in the modern or with the current internet, yes, but I'm rather trying to think in the context of this new future internet, which is content-based, which you don't care about location or who is serving it, is about the data and the naming of the data. And then you need to do those operations anyway, because the location and whoever is sending it, it doesn't tell you anything.
So Daniel, let me argue Robert's point, but maybe from a different angle, because I'm starting to mentally come around to this way of thinking. If an agent receives a connection request, and one of the options we have is to allow the user to accept the request and they hit a button to do so, in which case the label is important. The another paradigm is to have the expected behavior is that it just automatically accepts the request and then can engage in a subsequent exchange that more or less asks them to identify themselves with credentials. And then when you actually see the list of pending requests, connection requests, not a data exchange request, but a connection request, then you're actually going to see the results in place of that cryptographic exchange before you even get the thing to say, yes, I'm going to accept this connection. And if we reset the user paradigm, if you will, about how we anticipate these protocols being presented to the user, then the label in that place becomes meaningless, because the expectation is that invitations are either rejected out of hand or requests because they don't include something from an invitation, or they're accepted and immediately subsequent cryptographic verification happens, and then that information is presented to the user about whether they want to air quote accept that or not. And if they decide to reject it, then the DID exchange information will be discarded.
Completely got your point, and I'm afraid that the first use case where you need to do it manually, it won't be practical, because obviously there will be a lot of misuse of that communication, and then you will have labels like Google sending you an invitation or whatever you name the label, right? And the user he won't have the possibility to check it anyway by just accepting the invitation. and then you could receive like hundreds of those invitations, and then what, how you will deal with them.
So, from
a practical point of view, it's better to assume that actually it's automatically accepted to establish the trusted connection, and then do the verification, and then ask the user what you want to do with it.
So the expense of accepting this, going through this protocol, is significantly higher than the expense of a Diffie-Hellman exchange in HTTP, because you don't have the luxury of assuming duplex communication, which means that there could be latency between the time that you get your invitation and the time that you accept it. As a matter of fact, it could be a very large latency for public invitations, like Tobias has been talking about, where you have a website that publishes permanently an invitation to the world to connect. That could have been published 3 years ago. So the beginning phases and the latter phases of the protocol are not guaranteed to happen in real time. Furthermore, I don't think that a non-manual thing for human beings is practical. I think for corporations maybe, but I'll give you a specific use case. Alice goes to a conference. She goes out to dinner with a bunch of people afterwards, and five people are around the table. Two of them seem like nice people. One guy seems like a real jerk, and she doesn't want to talk to him. She gets five invitations from the five people around the table immediately at the end of dinner. They all arrive at approximately the same time, and they have nothing in them, no labels or anything. They just have five different keys. So would it be good for Alice to go through the protocol to connect to all five of those people and then decide that she wants to terminate the connection with two of them? Or would it be better for her to say, oh, I received an invitation and it has the label Fred on it. Now, it might not be Fred, but it seems like a good idea that I can ignore the one from Fred that I don't like. I don't think that's a bad...
I agree, but can I even just comment quickly on what Daniel said? Because this is what I'm thinking of, and this is how I understood it, is that when I receive this invitation, my software can resolve the ID which is within the invitation without establishing connection yet, show me all the relevant information which I want to see, and then I can decide if I can establish connection or not.
No, so, because it's a peer did.
Right.
You're assuming public dids where you can go look up on the ledger and find out the reputation of the party you're connecting to, and I'm not making that assumption.
Right. So, okay. I missed that. You're right.
Steve is next.
Daniel. Okay. So what Sam said was you accept the connection, your agent does it for you, and then your agent then does some sort of verifiable credential exchange with the other party's agent, and only then are you asked if you want to establish the connection or not. In other words, the DID exchange is completed, but a connection, we're redefining what the term connection is, such that it's post verifiable credential exchange. It's an interesting idea.
It is, and the point that I'd like to make is that there's two amounts of work we're considering. One is the cryptographic work by the agent on the phone, and I think the scale of five, I think you could just do that. I think you just go through the process of all five. It may get a little more complicated in the scale of, like, I don't know, 100 or 200, but my user interface, from the user perspective, it could not even show it as a pending connection until the credential exchange has actually occurred. So I'm actually really in line with what's being proposed here, because I think it's a really cool idea. But there's one very practical problem that we have, is that there's only one service right now where you can go actually get a verifiable credential that actually helps identify who you are. And that's the verified email service by BCGov. And so talking about the connection protocol at this level makes it very difficult, because we don't have a plethora of ways that businesses and people can identify themselves. And until that actually happens, it's difficult to design the protocol specifically for that expected use case. And so what I might propose is that we proceed with Label with all of its faults, and then work hard on solving that problem, and so that we can rev the DID exchange protocol or the user paradigm design guidelines around it to deprecate use of label and step into the area of identifying connections by credential rather than by self-asserted label.
I kind of get where you guys are going. I believe that the inefficiency of this protocol is significant, and we don't want to pay the cost of automatically connecting all the time. And I also don't believe in the notion that the first thing you always do is exchange credentials. I think that's total nonsense. Sometimes we might want to do it, but I meet people all the time on the street where I want to connect to them, but I don't necessarily want credentials from them. I'm perfectly happy with self-asserted data. If they want to call themselves FUBAR, they can do that, as far as I'm concerned. And imposing an artificial requirement that says, yes, the first thing that you have to do is get credentials from somebody, and until you get that, it's not a connection, I think is going way too far.
So I think what we can do is leave the DID exchange protocol as it is with a self-asserted label. And we need an RFC that describes user paradigms. And we can start that with the paradigm that they should have around the label. For example, there's a warning that it's self-asserted or other things like that. And then as we progress as a community, we can update that RFC or provide new RFCs that update the current expected user experience based upon how these protocols actually work. And you're right, Daniel, there's lots of cases where I might have a quick relationship with a vending machine and I don't actually care much about what's going on. And as this evolves, we'll be able to solve that problem. So we're not going to do that every time we establish a connection, certainly with a business or something we want to have a long relationship with. We are over time.
Go ahead, Dan. Just suggest a simple peace offering that might make some people a little happier. We could rename label to untrusted label or self-asserted label to make it crystal clear that the particular piece of data we're looking at is not something that's a basis for any trust.
It's less about the trust at the developer level and more at the trust at the human layer.
But if we label it that way, the developers are going to realize that it isn't untrusted and do a better job conveying that to the user.
I think that it will be misunderstood anyway on the user interface. But definitely I will propose to throw this issue to the UX, DID UX group, that where the user experience developers and people experiencing those processes, they are familiar with the how to tackle the problems from the user experience level. So it will be interesting to listen what they have to say.
So because that's always, good.
Always there is a discussion that starts that UX is not something which you put later on. The UX you need to start from scratch and then implement stuff according to that or design the protocols according to the UX. Otherwise you break stuff.
So excellent. If they work on UX, what I will do to this particular RFC is update it to indicate that what we're creating here is an exchange and basically a cryptographic tunnel. And I can include a note that implies that this doesn't necessarily mean that this connection is to be trusted in any particular way.
Yep.
And I think that will punt the issue over to hopefully, I would love the user experience folks to produce an RFC that describes the expected user experience and paradigms that should be present when you are actually connecting with someone else over a DID protocol. And renaming this to DID exchange instead of connections, I think helps that because this is the mechanical process of exchanging DIDs and implies less about what you're going to do after the DIDs are exchanged than you had before.
Yep. I will throw that topic to them and see if we can get some meaningful feedback.
Okay, I will put some work into this, and I apologize that we didn't get to other RFCs, but this was a useful conversation. And thank you all for being here, and I will get the call posted as soon as I can.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everybody.